This week on Decentralize,
Ross Ulbricht, convicted, guilty on all charges.
And we're looking forward to talking to Jeremy Gardner of the College Crypto Network.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
All right, so hot off the presses, we have Ross Ulbricht, convicted, guilty on all charges that were brought against him in this pegging of him as DPR. I figured this was going to happen, but it still really pisses me off. And I really hope that the appeal goes through. But this is a sad day for liberty and personal property rights. What do you think, James?
Yeah, you know, I'm like you said, I'm not actually particularly surprised. I think you anticipated this fairly early on, and it has been interesting to follow this trial. Obviously, I owe a lot of debt to Andy Greenberg of Wired for covering this and giving us a lot of good information, and also activists like Julia Turiansky for actually being at the event and watching this and kind of watching it unfold. But it is very, very sad, and that's kind of the main takeaway from this is I don't think it seems like a great length for the U.S. prosecution to go to supposedly, you know, fight this war on drugs to, like, ruin this young man's life. It's sad, but it seems somewhat inevitable. I do think, and one of the things which Andy Greenberg of Wired observed in his coverage of the event and coverage of sort of the defense's closing arguments and also their objections throughout the proceedings was that they were sort of laying the groundwork for a later appeal. They obviously, from the very beginning, they were objecting to the way this investigation was done, to the way the prosecution was handled, and to a lot of the somewhat spurious evidence produced, and some of the suspect links which were made between Ross's identity and that of DPR. So one of these things was actually, and one of the things which has been covered a lot in the past few weeks, was the insight that Ross Ulbricht had terrible security practices and made a lot of, you know, major flaws and errors. This is actually used by the defense, I think, interestingly, in saying that this is actually look like DPR in real life. Dread Pirate Roberts does not make these kind of rookie mistakes, like leaving unencrypted, you know, encryption keys on his computer or running Silk Road from a public library. But what do you think about that, Eric? Do you think I know you said before that you think it's fairly likely that Ross Ulbricht is DPR. Do you think that's an interesting a case, at least, and do you think that will be carried forward into appeal successfully?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I don't know if it's going to be a successful basis for the appeal, but I think it's a totally viable defense. The fact that you think that, you know, this person is running a multi, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of, you know, business, both illegal and legal in both cases, it requires a certain degree of operational security, or OPSEC, as described in the sort of security lingo. And the fact that, you know, they're bringing all this evidence to court and they're like, you know, it's so, like, blatantly obvious what it, like, that these mistakes he's making. Whoever DPR actually is, right, would not have made these mistakes. Otherwise, they would never have been able to develop, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of business, online business, while still maintaining his privacy and identity throughout, right? Imagine the level of coordination and detail that has to be undergone, and the level of just, like, basic information security that you have to pay so much attention to make this happen at all. I think it's a totally viable defense. I think the thing that really pisses me off the most, though, is that this is like yet another, this is probably the, if not the biggest one thereof, examples of a victim of this failed war on drugs, right? And you can look time and time again, and any country that sort of decriminalizes and or completely legalizes, you know, illicit drugs like this, drugs that could potentially be harmful, addictive substances like alcohol and sugar, that then the use of it becomes self-moderated naturally. You can look at the drug policy of Sweden. You can look at, you know, Australia. You can look at, you know, all of these different countries, even some states, for example, even some states like Colorado, I think they found that the number of incidents of crimes has completely plummeted, and that's not just drug-related crimes, but crimes in general, violent crimes, and they've generated so much tax revenue that they have to give it back to their citizens, right? Like, they've generated $300 or $400 million of extra revenue because it's been such a wild success. And the fact that this poor, this kid has to go back and, you know, is probably facing significant and lengthy jail time if the appeal doesn't go through.
30 years.
He's getting lambasted over this is ridiculous. It is a complete and total failure of the justice system. Certainly, we could come up with an alternative policy to if we want to, you know, protect the people from themselves and, you know, prevent them from doing things in the privacy of their own home. If that's something the government really wants to do, then the least we could do is come up with some sort of alternative policy for, like, you know, some sort of like, hey, get some psychiatric help if you need it, right? Not this like aggressive send them off to jail. You know what it's resulted in? It's resulted in the United States having among the populated countries the number one highest incarceration rate in the world, right? There is actually, even if you include all countries, there is only one country that is higher than the United States, and it's some tiny country with like 100,000 people and like off in the corner of somewhere in Africa, I think. And it's just absurd. Like, we're supposed to, like, the United States and these civilized, supposedly civilized countries, they're hardly civilized when they're criminalizing things like this, are lambasting Ross and countless others and sending them off to prison. It's un-fucking real, man.
And the funny thing is, really, and what the ironic thing, is that of the people actually doing something to change the way people consume drugs or to at least make it less violent, less associated with a lot of dangers, there is some case to be made that online drug marketplaces had some role in taking or had some role in removing drug violence from the streets and actually making drug use and drug sales reputation-based. So, I mean, obviously, we are endorsing either way, but if you look at what actually makes things better for people, it's very rarely, actually, it's almost never, I would venture, I'm waiting for evidence, but it's rarely state intervention. It's more often not entrepreneurship. And that is, if Ross is CPR, he was an entrepreneur. If he started the Silk Road and left it off to someone else, he was an inventor. And it is really a shame that, like, he's losing his life for this, so many years of his life for this. But I do wonder, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, whether you think this will have a chilling effect on other creators of these centralized platforms, because we're seeing so many of these now. It's actually proliferating faster than anyone can track, faster than I imagine the feds could litigate. Things like decentralized crowdsourcing platforms, decentralized trading platforms, anything like that. Do you think they'll have an impact on that, Eric, or do you think it's going to come back stronger, just like Silk Road 2 and Silk Road 3 did?
Well, that's the thing, is I do think it is going to have an impact. I just think it is going to be exactly the opposite impact that they intended to have, in that, okay, so the defense against, you know, Ross Ulbricht being DPR, largely based on this idea that it would be impossible for someone to run something of such magnitude with such poor information and operational security. Okay, well, everybody's going to look at what's happening here. And I'll go ahead and tell you, it is already happening. There are already, you know, several replacements for the Silk Road. There's already the Silk Road 3.0, by the way. It's just going to make it that much harder. These people are going to protect themselves. These people are going to just operate that much better and be that much more incentivized because it is more lucrative. And the argument for these marketplaces is they can get all the business because no one wants to deal with the violence of interacting with criminals on the streets. And again, if you follow that through logically, the reason you have to deal with criminals is because the act of this process, these substances, are criminalized. So who are going to be the only people who are willing to deal with, you know, actually the danger of buying and selling and holding these chemicals? In many cases, just simple flowers that are completely natural, or mushrooms that are completely natural. Of course, they're going to be violent criminals who have guns to protect themselves from thieves, because this is high-value stuff, because it's hard to get, because the market doesn't exist, because it's been illegalized. Like, yeah, I think that there's going to be a massive positive impact on visibility into sort of these moral questions, subsequently the operational concerns of how to operate them, right? How to actually run one without getting busted. And I'm sure this isn't the first, you know, dark market bust. I don't even want to call it a dark market anymore. I want to start calling these like open trade markets, like free and open trade zones, digital trade zones, something like that. Because the point is, people want to trade and they want to do so safely and securely. It is an utter travesty where your government is actively obstructing the act of free trade. And that's what it boils down to for me. And I am very excited to see things like Open Bazaar, right? All of the other marketplaces that have sort of sprung up in the wake of Silk Road. I'm very excited for the implications on human liberty that, you know, this is all going to cause, right? Maybe if it weren't for Silk Road, these markets would have just stayed quiet and this never would have entered the public discussion. So for that, DPR is already a hero. Ross Ulbricht, secondarily, is now becoming a hero because he's sort of bringing attention to this. I mean, I hate to call it, you know, a martyrism, but I think it really is important, like what's happening right now. It's bringing attention where maybe none would have been brought. So yeah, I think it's going to have a very positive impact on liberty and freedom, and that more of these places will exist.
Trade you're talking about are nothing new for sure, but perhaps this something like this trial is. Putting on trial decentralization as an idea and as a way of building platforms and building trade, this is perhaps, you know, one of the biggest cases for that in, you know, the most recent years. I do think it is going to be interesting to see how these platforms respond and also how the appeal carries forward. And for any of our listeners who are interested in sort of hearing about Ross's case and even supporting Ross's defense fund, I definitely personally recommend freeross.org. Send him a few bits if you want. Let's take advantage of the fact that we have this payment network, decentralized payment network, and support the causes we believe in if you do believe in it. But that being said, and our best wishes being with Ross and his family, let's move on to perhaps some other interesting developments for Bitcoin, because just like we're seeing really the first big trial where Bitcoin is really at stake, we're also seeing increased merchant adoption, increased awareness of Bitcoin, and we're also seeing an increased awareness of other forms of decentralization, like the sharing economy. The Uber protest going on in San Francisco right now, and the growing sort of a turn back against the sharing economy. We also saw this week that payment processor Adyen, which processes payments for sharing economy companies like Airbnb and I believe also Uber, in addition to Braintree, is accepting Bitcoin. So we're seeing this interesting influence of these companies having the opportunity to turn towards more decentralization, and a lot of pushback against what many protesters view as either a too centralized system or a too decentralized one. But what do you think about all this? How do you put all this together, and what do you think the impact of
So the Uber thing has really
these moves is going to be?
Yeah. So the Uber thing has been really interesting to me. Not only because they're sort of disrupting something, and disruption of, you know, sort of existing status quos has always been something I've been very, very fascinated by. It's really interesting to see Uber taking pieces of the idea of decentralization, right, and creating a, almost it's a marshaled marketplace in that there is an overseer and a party that's responsible for facilitating the whole endeavor. But they're taking the essence of decentralization and free and open trade and applying it to an industry like the transportation industry, and have achieved wild success as a result, not just Uber, but Lyft and all of the other various competitors. It's really awesome seeing success on this, but it is only one small step towards the greater goal, which I think perhaps the answer here, in much the same way that dark markets or open markets are now the sort of the answer to increasing regulation on trade, perhaps a truly decentralized, by that I mean drivers can simply opt in based on their reputation to receive, they just sign up for the app. There's no approval process, it's pure reputation. Because if these companies are going to start getting sued, right, are start going to have all these protests and legal concerns, and there is an entity that can be sued at all, why don't we just do away with the corporation and just make a network, right? And I think that is going to be the end-all solution. But I got a funny message from my one of my friends out in San Francisco. He was like, yeah, guess who just took an Uber to the Uber protest? This guy. And I was just like, that just goes to show like the power and the strength of a decentralized network, right? Where, yes, there's protests going on the very same service that you're using, but you still have the network is resilient to that. And that you can actually go take the same service to go attend that. And I thought that was utterly fascinating to me. So this Uber protest thing has been interesting. I really hope that it kind of pushes people to create some of these more truly decentralized solutions. Maybe it becomes a DAO or a DAC or whatever we're calling it these days, where there is no entity in control of it. It's just sort of a self-sustaining network.
That's a really interesting parallel, and great to draw that back actually to what we were discussing about with the open markets. It does seem that in a lot of these cases with decentralized technologies, it usually takes some kind of gatekeeper or firm at least to carry the decentralized sort of platform forward. Like in the case of the Silk Road, it had to be sort of DPR or someone with to provide sort of the efficiency of centralization and actually getting that decentralized platform out. But I do think it's a very great point that this is something which can be fully decentralized. It can, imagine, and I would like to get your feedback on this actually as an engineer. What would be the obstacles to creating something like that, to creating a fully decentralized app marketplace for ride sharing, to integrating, payment methods like, say, Bitcoin, where it is completely decentralized and not under, the control of Uber, who can, sometimes do some shady things.
So the obstacles are not technical in any way. It would be very trivial. It would be a weekend hackathon project to basically put together a working model of this. The challenge in these networks is always achieving critical mass. You're going to have to get it over the hump for it to even be useful. How many times have you signed up for like some new app, some new network, social network, or what website, and you sign in and you're really excited about it, you've read through its marketing message, you're like, wow, I really believe in what these guys are doing, I love this idea, this is a cool concept, and you log in, and it's a ghost town. But because you still believe in the idea, you're like, that's okay, I'm going to get my friends to join. And so you invite a few people, maybe one or two kind of stick around, and you come back, log in tomorrow, and maybe there's one extra post, and it just fizzles out. That's always the challenge in launching something like this, and I view this as more of an entrepreneurial challenge than a technical challenge. And the other thing that's going to be really difficult, the second hurdle, and I think this is why it is good that this is becoming a discussion point, is the question of reputation, is how do we build a reputation network that doesn't have someone standing behind it. I think Bitcoin is starting to answer this question in a lot of ways through, by extension, Namecoin and some of these other technologies that allow you to register an identity of sorts and then assert yourself as being a holder of that identity. Because, like, if you look at some of the things I think that were happening in India, or, yeah, I think it was India, where Uber, like, some of the drivers were being accused of, you know, sexual assault, and, you know, that's absurd, and that should not be acceptable, but it's not acceptable in any capacity, right? So how do you prevent that in a system where when you enter in, you can basically pick up anybody at any time. You know, your first ride, you could be that criminal. You could be that violator of rights. And now what? Now you just re-register a new identity. So account for that with an upfront cost is one proposal. You say, in order to get reputation, you know, you have to deposit this, right? You have to deposit a certain amount. James, what do you think about, you know, solving that specific problem?
Yeah, it's really interesting, and like you were saying, I think the two major problems of any kind of decentralized service like this, where it's fully open decentralized, is one, marketing it, because again, you have to have the incentive behind it, and that's obviously a lot of the problems with a lot of like really awesome projects that were been launched maybe in the 90s or early 2000s, but just haven't been picked up. And the other one, obviously, is, you know, how do we had no barriers to entry whatsoever, which is like a great thing, and you know it's a very important part of actually freeing a market. But people do demand some kind of assurance that they're not going to be picked up by those murderers or rapists, like you're talking about. Totally reasonable. One thing I might consider as a proposal to that is not actually making it a vertically integrated system where you have background checks being provided by the provider of the app, but actually have third-party services that people can independently contract with to ensure that the people who are picking them up are good, or that drivers themselves could actually use to add an extra layer of, you know, authenticity or verification to themselves, just optionally. Make it optional, make it completely outside of the actual use of the app, but have competing agencies offering those kind of But what do you think of the next steps?
I think they're going to dominate the market for the next couple of years. The sort of underlying infrastructure, like payment channels and trustless contracts, they really need to be built out in order for these things to actually be built, because we don't actually know how they work in the real world in a lot of cases. I know the Blockstream guys are working on a lot of really cool you know, sidechain work a lot. There's a number of other companies working on payment channels and how do you do like small per unit charges against a based customer. How do you do instant confirmations? I know BitPay recently launched Impulse. These are the pieces that are sort of like the next layer on top of Bitcoin's sort of block basis, right? And now we're building out this next layer, which enables all of these services. So I think it'll be a couple more years before we really start to see a network that does that. But I know that it will happen, and it'll certainly happen within the decade, if not within the next 5 years.
It's hopeful to me. I think this has been a great conversation, and we're looking forward to talking to Jeremy Gardner of the College Crypto Network and the Augur Project, one of these decentralized platforms that we're very excited about, up next.
All right, today we have Jeremy Gardner, Executive Director of the College Cryptocurrency Network and Director of Operations at Augur. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, it's an utter pleasure. So talk to us a little bit about what is Augur and what is it that you're doing.
Okay, so Augur's really cool. Tony knows all about it. But what we're doing is we're taking blockchain technology and, in my mind, really applying it to a consumer use case, in the first world at least, for the very first time, by taking prediction markets, which are pretty much just markets where people bet on the outcomes of future events such as presidential elections or academic research, whatever you please, and buy shares of yes or no of whether something's going to happen. And that to me is really exciting, because betting is something people love to do, something they traditionally have not been able to do online. By putting prediction markets on the blockchain, they can do it now. So that's what Augur is.
And as a quick follow-up to that, since I joined the Augur team, I got a chance to, you know, go out to San Francisco and meet everyone. I can't say enough about everyone in the group is incredibly bright. They really know the product well. I learned a bunch just by hanging out with them. And the other thing I had the pleasure to do was meet Robin Hanson, someone who I wasn't really familiar with, how influential he was, not just with the prediction market scene and the whole Bayesian Bayesian statistics scene, but really a part of the early crypto scene and hanging out with the cypherpunks and Tim May and things like that. He has roots in there, and it's very interesting to see how close these worlds are and how they're going to get closer. And, you know, this is really cool because we were able to bring Jeremy on today, and we really want to talk mostly about college crypto, but really the Augur team is turning out to be like an all-star team that's trying to execute this, and I can't say enough for everyone about it. But with that being said, I do want to go into the CCN, because that's actually how I met you at the first time, Jeremy. How and why did you start this? Were you a part of what started CCN? And, you know, tell us how big it's grown since you started it.
So my experience with the CCN is really just reflective of my entire experience with Bitcoin, in that the first time I was introduced to Bitcoin was reading a Rolling Stone article about the Silk Road and how you can buy drugs on the internet now. And I was like, well, that's interesting. But it didn't seem to have much value to me. And I didn't really return to Bitcoin for another year until the fall before this, in which I was told by my friends that the value of Bitcoin was about to skyrocket. It was at about 200. And, you know, I don't typically take my friends' investment advice, but I did my research. I saw all this sentiment was building. So then the Silk Road closed, bought in. Maybe it was right before or after that. But then the price shot up to $1,000. I got out. I was like, all right, this is too good to be true. Sold my Bitcoin and was like, all right, this tool is good for buying drugs and as a speculative investment. But I didn't really understand the value of the blockchain until I transferred to the University of Michigan last winter. And I moved in with a fellow named Kennard Hockenhull, who was he started the second U.S. Bitcoin exchange in the United States, and went through the Boost Accelerator. When I met him, his company had been defrauded, and he was kind of restructuring, and he was in Ann Arbor. And, you know, I just happened to move in with all of his former fraternity brothers, and he was crashing with them at the time. And, you know, I was the only one that would humor him about Bitcoin because I knew what it was. I had had some positive experiences with it. And so I listened to him, and, well, he's a pretty hardcore anarchist. He started to talk about this blockchain, and I started to read about it and found it really compelling. So when I was asked to join the University of Michigan Bitcoin Club, I was like, sure, I'll go. And didn't really make much of it. But my first Michigan Bitcoin Club meetup, a reporter from USA Today comes along, and she's talking about, in the middle of our interview, how there are similar Bitcoin clubs at MIT and Stanford. Now, to me, this was really interesting because I had recently worked in political campaigns and been really disillusioned by the American political system, but I still had a deep desire to organize. So I asked the reporter to put us in touch with those other students at MIT and Stanford, and she did. And that night, in fact, we ended up on a phone call with them. And Danny, the head of the Michigan Bitcoin Club and who go on to become my co-founder of the CCN, was speaking to those students about their respective successes and failures as clubs, how they could better organize, sharing resources. And I was like, hey, why don't we create an organization out of this? About a month later, the CCN was born. Fast forward about 10 months later to today, and we're now a federal tax-exempt organization, 501c3. We've got chapters in about 35 countries, every habitable continent, and about 160 schools worldwide. We've hosted over 24 events around the world, and there's no sign of letting up. And I guess that's a quick summary of CCN, kind of how I got involved. Oh, and my driving factor in founding CCN was that I realized that, look, if I actually had used Bitcoin or seen Bitcoin be purchased and bought and only thought it was good for buying drugs or speculating, and then realizing much later on that it was actually this incredibly transformative technology, maybe as transformative as the internet, that there was a huge information problem. And that was why the need for the CCN arise, because there were no professors, academics, professionals really talking about Bitcoin and the blockchain in an intelligent manner. So I thought it was vastly important that we create a generation of what I call cryptocurrency communicators.
So Jeremy, in your communication with a lot of the students in the College Cryptocurrency Network, what do you find to be the most common story for how people came to find Bitcoin? You have a really fascinating one yourself, but what are sort of the demographics of the people you see and the motivations that are bringing them to this technology?
So what really amazes me more than anything is the fact that Bitcoin seems to transcend socioeconomic background, religious beliefs, geographic positioning. I mean, we're in 10 countries in Africa. We have students that have lived through civil wars. And then we have super affluent kids as well that, they're old money in England, What the most defining characteristic of young Bitcoiners is not any given characteristic, but just the notion that this technology has the power to transform the world. So I'll take an example from one of my students from Ghana, who was saying to me how he wanted the people of Ghana to use Bitcoin because they fell so far behind with the internet revolution. And he saw so much potential in this Bitcoin technology that he wanted to bring it to these people, to his people, before the rest of the world adopted it. In other places in the world, I mean, it's the idea that you can transfer value or you can decentralize. Some people want to subvert government, to me, it's just the understanding that this technology is the brink of something extraordinarily special that may not be fully developed yet, but has the potential to change the world, and each and every one of these students want to be a part of that change.
Excellent. So what's next? Like, what are some of the most ideal communities that you'd want to see sort of involved with College Cryptocurrency Network? Who's ideal?
So, I mean, I think every young person is ideal because there's not a single young person in the world, I mean, maybe in very isolated communities, that haven't been affected by the aftermath of 9/11, being in this kind of national security state globally. And then also this great recession that we've lived through. So I guess, to me, I want to see the people who can benefit most. I think those people that have been disenfranchised in the past, lack of access to bank accounts, lack of access to the internet, and really see Bitcoin be able to empower those people, cryptocurrencies be able to empower those people. But it's a slow process. You have to have education. You have to have the means to kind of help communities embrace this technology. So I think we're on the right path. I don't really have any target demographics because, like I said, we're in 10 countries in Africa. I'd like to see us expand more in Latin America. We're looking to translate all of our materials into Spanish. I think that's a huge target region that we haven't been nearly involved enough in. But overall, I mean, if we can stay on the trajectory we've been on for the past 10 months, I'd be absolutely delighted because we have accomplished so much and our students have done so much without us providing lots of money or anything. So to me, when people ask, do you want to raise a bunch of money, I'm hesitant because, we have been developed in a very decentralized manner. And when students need money, we'd like to connect them to sponsors and individuals that can help them. But as an organization, I'm really satisfied with the trajectory that we're on.
Excellent. So you're talking a little bit about the Latin American markets. Can you unwrap that a little bit? What's so exciting about, Central and South America that really makes you think that Bitcoin really needs to be present there?
Well, you look at places like Venezuela and Argentina, places that have experienced horrible hyperinflation. And, we complain about the collapse and the fluctuations in Bitcoin, but hyperinflation is 1,000 times worse because it only really moves in one way. And, the people in Venezuela and people in Argentina and elsewhere, they're pretty computer savvy folks. And with the capital controls that exist in those countries, Bitcoin has a huge potential to affect those people and help them move their money around without kind of government interference. And, I'm what most Bitcoiners would call a statist, But by the extent of control that the state has over the lives of the people in many countries in Latin America, I think Bitcoin has a huge transformative potential to the for them. And you know, speaking to some of our students in Argentina, you know, they had to smuggle the first Bitcoin ATM into that country. So I know there's potential, but it's not that still needs to be fully cracked.
And I think this is a little on the last topic regarding the growth that we had talked about a minute ago. And this is something that I think gives Bitcoin instant credibility. So I want to laud you for doing this. But what are some of the higher profile schools that are involved in the CCN? Because whenever I see the list, you mentioned a few, but I want you to mention them again and maybe some other ones that we didn't talk about. Because when mainstream media hears academia is adopting this, and I believe I think I heard it from you that Princeton has now added a class or a course on Bitcoin.
Yep.
You hear things like Ivy League schools talking about it. It gives it a credibility that, you know, really you can't get anywhere else, and it makes people listen way more. So first of all, congratulations. Second of all, who else is involved? Just name a few of the biggest names.
Thank you. I mean, obviously the founding chapters, Michigan, Stanford, MIT have been huge. MIT, we gave $100 in Bitcoin to every undergraduate. It reached almost every single student. That was huge, obviously. MIT just released the MIT Bitcoin Club, our chapter there, released a great video yesterday explaining how MIT students could spend Bitcoin. So that's been awesome. Stanford, they're doing academic research. Susan Athey, she's a professor there. She does great stuff. Our McGill chapter, which was recently incorporated into the CCN, just announced that they're also going to do a Bitcoin drop as well. The University of Toronto is intimately involved with the Decentral guys in Toronto, and they're looking to host a huge hackathon in Canada in late spring. Overseas, I mean, we have incredible students in Ghana, at Kenyatta University in Kenya. They've had this the Minister of Finance of Kenya come to their student meetup. So you know, it kind of is all over the world. You know, the United States has been a launching ground, but I'm excited to see what happens elsewhere as well.
Jeremy, you've had some really incredible success, but I imagine that you've also met with a great deal of skepticism. I'm wondering what the greatest obstacles have been for you and the College Crypto Network to actually introducing Bitcoin to academics and academic institutions. And if you want to follow up on that, conversely, what are the greatest obstacles to introducing these to students?
So one of the first obstacles we found was when we tried to get the University of Michigan to accept Bitcoin donations. We thought it would be the easiest thing in the world. You know, it's just like they have nothing to lose. Most large institutions already accept stock and artwork. So, you know, it wouldn't be a far reach, especially using a payment processor such as Bitcoin or BitPay or Coinbase, to really just have it immediately converted into fiat, taking on no risk. We kind of pitched all of that to the University of Michigan, and then the marketing departments and development departments were all about it. But somewhere along, either in treasury or legal, the school was just like, no, we're not going to do that. And that was kind of stunning to me. I was like, look, this is just free money you can get. Like, why won't you take this? But it's an information bias. It's an information shortfall. You know, there's all these negative associations with this technology and not understanding how payment processing works, which shouldn't be a hard thing to do or to explain, except when you don't get to speak to all the participants. Academics are better. Academics can be very receptive. I speak to a lot of academics. And, you know, I think one thing that's actually amazed me about this technology is how receptive academics are. You know, my dad's a college professor. He doesn't get it, but he teaches Chinese history, so I don't really expect him to. But the individuals that choose to take the time to learn how Bitcoin works and understand the blockchain technology and what underlies Bitcoin, those folks really do get it. Harvey Campbell over at Duke, NYU professors there. Princeton has a whole bunch of Bitcoin development going on. Stanford, like I said, you know, there are professors that are receptive to this. They're just kind of scattered. And I think as a lot of PhDs become professors. You're going to see that because there's a lot of academic research being conducted in this space. So as frustrating as it can be to deal with large academic institutions, as long as the academics themselves are beginning to acknowledge the value of this technology, that's incredibly important. You look at Coin Center, led by Jerry Brito, who's over at George Mason, and you know that there are these academics in this space. It just takes time. But I think it's the rate of academic research in this space is going to grow exponentially in the coming couple years.
That's fantastic to hear. I think Princeton has done a lot of research into crypto in general, you know, Johns Hopkins University. So it's really exciting to hear. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Augur. And why a prediction market? You know, what is the big need in cryptocurrency for a prediction market?
Well, it's not about cryptocurrency at the end of the day. It's about humans. You know, betting is a $1 trillion industry, and just over 1% of it occurs online. To me, that's crazy for multiple reasons. First, it's just like betting's an easy thing to do online. But secondly, right now, the way that betting is conducted throughout the world, this $1 trillion industry, it has no social net benefit. There's no positive outcome. You know, some people make money, some people lose it, but there's no societal gain. But with prediction markets, there's a huge social benefit. Prediction markets, you know, while some people bet no that something is going to happen, some people bet yes, those bets eventually converge to a percentage, like 63% of people say something's going to happen, and that you can use, that 63% can be used as actual likelihood that an event will occur, whether Hillary Clinton gets elected or not, and that percentage, that convergence has been proven in multiple economic and economic studies to actually be an excellent indicator of whether something will happen. So if we can take a small fraction of this $1 trillion industry, put it on the blockchain, on a prediction market, and have that convergence occur in real time, you potentially have the most powerful forecasting tool in human history, while allowing people to do something they do already, but now just in a socially beneficial way. The fact that this uses Bitcoin just allows people from all over the world to participate, but it's not actually an essential feature of the technology.
And I think that's one of the more interesting parts, and that's what got me as a part of the team is and sold me on it, is the ability to use a cryptocurrency as the way to incentivize good predictions. And, you know, it's something where when you say the word prediction market, you know, I did a lot of studying before I joined the team via documents Jeremy sent me, and, you know, just good old-fashioned Googling. And I kind of realized something, that this is lacking. This is a tool that's lacking, and it's a tool that really is something academics really want, social scientists want, scientists in general want, mathematicians want, because there is something to this, you know, this accuracy that is in crowds. And to that, what I also think is that as statistical methods get more advanced, and by advanced I mean more thought out as far as just the entire process. I'm a very Bayesian fan. I had a very good conversation with Joey from the team that we're having on next week. And we spoke about this when I was in San Francisco. And you're going to see that as these sophisticated methods become more in use, they're going to grow, and the accuracies just continue to you know, snowball. And again, with us meeting with Robin Hanson, just speaking with him for a few minutes on this really taught me a lot, that this is an idea that is thought of by some economists, but other economists never even thought of this being a method to make better decisions. You know, and when you Google it and you do more research, you realize people are saying things like, it's the killer app for Bitcoin. You know, academia really wants this. This is something that could benefit a lot of people. There's so many interesting aspects that are converging, especially things that interest me all at once here. I can't say enough positive about that, and that's why you say why Augur, it took me a minute to figure out why Augur too, but once I figured it out, it was just the pieces fell together. But Eric, I'm sure you and James have more awesome questions, so I'm going to toss it back to you to ask Jeremy.
So I want to talk a little bit about some of the first, like, initial targets for a prediction market, whether it's cryptocurrency or not, right? You know, what is, like, the first use case? We talk in entrepreneurship and startups about making sure you nail down a niche. What is that first niche for Augur?
So you're gonna have multiple markets that are gonna rise very quickly because this is fully decentralized. Some of which will be out of our control, but you know there are a lot of things people like to bet on that they can't right now. Most things, in fact, and those sorts of markets are gonna be created pretty early on. But markets for presidential elections, especially in foreign countries where people may not have access to these sorts of tools, real good like forecasting tools, this could be incredibly important. You look in most of Africa, most elections are rigged, and the idea that there can be kind of this impartial like forecasting tool that may not reflect what actually occurs in the elections, but may reflect the truth or of sentiment, it is very interesting. Furthermore, as a hedging tool, especially for like farmers in Latin America that want to hedge against crops, that's incredibly powerful. Because you know they may not have agricultural insurance like they have in the developed world. I can't say for sure what will be the killer apps, but I think some of the apps that people probably can't find right now on the internet will initially draw them to Augur, and then will end up leading to other more socially beneficial markets being seeded.
I'm absolutely fascinated by this, Jeremy. There's an idea in political theory called regime uncertainty, and I can see this, as you were saying, with presidential elections in countries with corrupt governments. This could really help a lot of people. I mean, by removing a lot of that uncertainty about rules that will be coming down or various impositions. But what I'm very interested in is how you think governments will react to this, actually, because it is a betting platform. It does have a lot of somewhat controversy around it from a legal perspective. But what do you think are the obstacles you'll be facing, and if any, and how do you plan to move forward in that?
Of course. I mean, legally speaking, we're on very solid ground for Augur as, like, legally being safe. We don't really fall under any federal agency's jurisdiction. This is a massive legal gray area. There are no laws that really apply to us. Will we piss off governments? Absolutely. I mean, I studied political strategy in college. It was a major I developed. A big part of it was game theory, but also political science, social psychology, military strategy. And the notion that this sort of tool like Augur will bring out truth is incredibly politically dangerous. It can incentivize whistleblowing of corruption, of misbehavior by governments, and that's incredibly threatening. At the same time, however, once you throw this on the blockchain and it's decentralized, there's not much these governments can do. It's the same thing with Bitcoin. You can ban it, but like, I know plenty of Russians that have Bitcoin. We actually have a secret club over there. So, you know, you can try to ban a decentralized technology, but once it's out in the open, it's going to be there forever, whether or not it works.
I completely agree, and I also think that when it comes to this, there is enough layers with using cryptocurrency as the way to you know, benefit from it. I think that's another interesting point that, you know, as we get closer to releasing more about the project, that we're going to, you know, there's going to be a lot of little intricacies that we're going to go into further detail on and the way it's used. So, you know, it's really going to be something that's going to be interesting, but I think we're on the safe side from everything I've seen and all the research of Jeremy and our attorneys and our yet-to-be attorneys, I'm sure will conclude with us. So we have, like, a lot of people we've spoken with and even more that we're hoping to speak with to make sure our ground's covered. And, you know, I think as something with Augur, you know, there's so much social benefit, and there is such a strong positive need for this in academia that, you know, we really think that, you know, the title prediction market kind of says it all, and that's why I really like that title, because we're not trying to, you know, act as someone that's taking bets. We're here trying to incentivize good decision-making. There's a difference. And, you know, again, I keep quoting Robin Hanson, but I can't, that just because of how impressed I was with hearing him speak. He basically just, you know, explained in really clear terms that is what you say you expect and you're hoping to achieve isn't always what you really want to achieve, and your decision making can have a lot of influences that are not as simple as is this the best decision. They can have social, political, cultural, you know, things that are really influencing your decisions that actually, you know, result in you making that decision not for the best and maybe not the most accurate decision that you could. These are human behavior things, and the first way to answer that is to get solid data, and you know, the crowd is a really great way to do that. You know, the other thing I learned as part of, you know, learning about prediction markets was how many companies also employ prediction markets internally. I know Google's one. Jeremy, I would love it if you can go to a little more detail about that, because you were fascinating when you told me about it.
Absolutely. So Tony was like, oh, we should focus on applying prediction markets to companies because, you know, it's a great forecasting tool, especially when people are incentivized to be honest. But in fact, this is actually a heavily used tool internally at IBM, Hewlett-Packard, Google, as Tony said. The French government uses it. The Department of Defense uses these prediction markets. They're a wildly popular tool because people are honest about what they think is going to happen, and it gives organizations a good sense of how reasonable they should be with their predictions. Now, sometimes C-suite individuals don't like to have their own estimates being undermined by the crowd, but overall, these are very popular and effective tools, both internally in organizations and societally.
That's fantastic. Thanks so much, Jeremy, for being able to join us today. I want to wrap this up with, is there anything remaining that you want to sort of plug? Where can people find out about Augur? Where can they find out about the College Cryptocurrency Network? Tell us some things that you want to plug, and then we'll go ahead and wrap it up.
We've got some good URLs. For CCN, it's just collegecrypto.org. If you're a student, registration's super easy. We'll guide you through the whole process, help you set up a club, get you in touch with good people, get you internships, bring you into this community, which is probably the most important thing that our organization can do. Augur, we don't have too much going on right now publicly. You can go to augur.net. You can sign up for our newsletter. And then we'll have alpha and beta testing in the coming months, a crowd sale in May. But for now, just follow us on Twitter. It's Augur Project. That's all of our that's our social media handle for every website. So easy to access, easy to find. You can follow me on Twitter. My handles have been here the whole time. I'm not that interesting, though, so I think that's all my fault.
You are. You're a fascinating individual, Jeremy. Trust me.
Again, Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a very enjoyable chat, and we hope to have you on again in the future.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.